know this is the end. You're wondering now what to do. Now you know this is the end.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
That is a sigh of relief, because Fun Drive 2017 is officially over. To everyone who donated their time, energy, money, forgot to donate now but will donate online at citr.ca, couldn't donate this year but will donate in the future, and to our community as a whole, CITR and Discorder want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just like thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for trusting us with your money, and we promise to make good use of it.
Muchas gracias. Gracias, gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Merci, genre infiniment.
Thank you, everybody. That was great.
El show de Leo Ramírez, lunes 4 a 5 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM, CITR. The Leo Ramírez Show, Monday 4 to 5 p.m. at 101.9 FM, CITR.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
What time of day should I sing my song? Should I sing it in the morning before anything goes wrong? There's only me and you and a honeysuckle dew. I can sing I love you, and you know I really do. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Unceded Airwaves broadcasts every week from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Hi, you're listening to Season 2, Episode 25 of Unceded Airwaves. On today's show, Clara Salter brings us an update on the response to the Nathan E. Stewart spill, and we'll also be talking about the anniversary of the Battle at Vimy Ridge and Hardline Productions' powerful new play, Red Patch.
My name is Josh Keoki. I'm from the Attawapiskat First Nation. And I'm very happy to be a part of the Indigenous Collective putting on this show. So I'm pleased to be here on unceded Musqueam territory as an uninvited guest.
I'm also pleased to be here. Tanche, Carly, Deshnikanshon. Hello, my name is Carly. My ancestry is Cree Métis on my dad's side and Icelandic on my mom's side. My Métis family is originally from the Red River settlement in Manitoba, but I was raised outside the community on unceded Stolo territory. I acknowledge that I'm an uninvited guest on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Marcy to the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people who host us today on their territory.
Good morning. My name is Clara Salter. I grew up in Okanagan Territory and am now also a grateful and uninvited guest on beautiful Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam Territory. I come from Irish, Scottish, and English ancestry, and I am also really excited for today's show.
We are the Indigenous Radio Collective. Every week we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We're a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
So we strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous people. Self-representation in the media is something that Indigenous people do not often have access to. So this show gives us an opportunity to share and define who we are as Indigenous people. Our cultures are incredibly diverse, and the nuances of our diversity are not always represented in mainstream broadcast media. It can be difficult to find positive role models that who are also Indigenous in the mainstream media, so this show offers us an opportunity to highlight some very influential Indigenous people.
If you can relate to the goals of the show and are wondering how to get involved, please reach out to us. You can always reach us on our social media, Facebook, Twitter. If you have a voice for decolonization, then we want to hear from you. Everyone is welcome, and there's no experience necessary. We're not doing our weekly meetings over the summer semester, but Josh says you should come camping with us this summer if you'd like to learn more. It's going to be a blast. If you'd like to get involved but you don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways to participate in this collective.
You can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. And if you're aware of any great Indigenous artists, please do send us a tweet using the hashtag UncededMusic or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we'll do our best to get it on air. We're always looking for some good new tunes to play. And if you send us a song, we'll give you a shout out.
We're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to, so let us know about any artists that you might be into. But what events you're putting on or you're going to that are in the community, any story pitches you might have for us, something that you feel we could be poised to cover. As always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode later in the show. We'll have our weekly Unceded events listing to share a little later.
So before we begin, we'd like to give shout-outs to those occupying their territories, including Maddie Lee of the Gitxsan Nation, the Unistoten of the Wet'suwet'en peoples, those occupying Lilu Island and Tsimshian territory, the Tsilhqot Nation, who are legally battling Tatsiko Mine Limited, and the Nachonayakdun, Trondakwichin, Tetlikwichin, and Buntakwichin, who are fighting to protect the Peel River watershed.
And a big thanks to our show sponsors, NORAD Electric. Formed 30 years ago, they provide commercial, industrial, and residential electric work. Owned and operated by Norman Day of the Tahltan Nation. We are also sponsored by Decolonizing Water, which is a project which aims to support water security for Indigenous communities. The project is funded by Social Science and Humanities Research Council. The project will run from 2016 to 2023 and brings together leading Indigenous thinkers, natural scientists, artists, lawyers, and community members. Rooted in Indigenous law, it will use the most innovative Western scientific advancements in monitoring technology to create a hybridized water governance and monitoring program. And so we're putting on our show today. I don't know if this is the first show this season that Lisa's not been on.
Yeah, we're Lisa-less today.
We're Lisa-less today.
We miss you, Lisa.
So if anything goes wrong, feel free to blame me. I know that I will. But we're just going to have a few, an ad and a promo here, and then a little bit of music, and we'll get into our show.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosions.
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band, swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Tomorrow brings in the world.
was Buffy St. Marie singing Up Where We Belong from her 1996 album of the same name. Buffy St. Marie is a Plains Cree from the Qu'Appelle Valley.
And up next, we're talking about Vimy Ridge. Apparently yesterday was the centennial of that happening. And Vimy Ridge is kind of one of those... one of those Canadian things.
Yeah, it was apparently yesterday was the 100th anniversary since the beginning of the battle, which concluded on the 14th, if I'm correct.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Vimy Ridge holds this held in very high regard in Canada. I feel like as like I went to like in middle school, you go to like you go to history class and it's like the First World War. It's like Vimy Ridge, and that's basically all, it's like the birth of Canada as a truly its own nation. So there's a lot of mythology caught up in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of Canadian patriotism attached to the Battle of Vimy Ridge, which is has been known as a turning point and to have been largely executed by Canadian soldiers.
Yeah, so I guess a bit of background, between 1914, 1918, over 4,000 Indigenous soldiers volunteered to fight and die for Canada in the First World War. So one such soldier was Cree Métis marksman Henry Norwest, who served as a sniper during the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Norwest was profiled recently on the CBC, so he's been getting some historical glances his way. Historians have praised Norwest's stealth, his ability to use camouflage very effectively, and his cool-headed detachment in battle. And a fellow soldier credited him as understanding better than anyone, or better than most of us, the cost of life and the price of death. Despite being awarded a military medal for his efforts to help Allied forces capture a significant point along the ridge and a posthumous military bar, Norwest's name was not included on the cenotaph at the Fort Saskatchewan Legion until 2008. Dutchy Enders, the services officer for the Legion, was quoted by the CBC as saying, "He should have been there a long time ago," and that he believed Norwest's contribution to the war effort was previously overlooked because he was Indigenous. Indigenous peoples serving in the war regularly faced racial prejudice and still left a remarkable record of wartime accomplishment. This is addressed in the Hardline Productions' new play, Red Patch, which just finished a run at the Presentation House in North Vancouver and will run from April 12th to 16th at Studio 16 here in Vancouver. So, Carly, you actually saw one of the productions of Red Patch.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago at the, maybe it was over a month ago now. Time's flying. Yeah, at the Talking Stick Festival, I saw a what's called the dramatic reading of Red Patch. So
Yeah. Never mind.
That's it. See, we're lost without Lisa.
I was just going to make a stupid joke. Was it dramatic?
It was toast dramatic.
Okay.
Yeah. Red Patch is the brainchild of Hardline artistic directors Sean Harris Oliver and Rhys Calvert. Calvert and Oliver co-wrote Red Patch after learning about the contributions of Indigenous soldiers to World War I. Red Patch is a historical drama that focuses on a young Métis soldier from the Newchalneth Nation of Vancouver Island who volunteers to fight for Canada in the First World War. Set in both Canada and the battlefields of France, Red Patch follows the experiences of this young soldier as he endures the horrors of war. So as Josh said, yeah, I was lucky enough to catch a dramatic reading of Red Patch at the Talking Stick Festival. It's different from a full production in that there's no staging. The actors are basically lined up, dressed in stage blacks. They had their scripts in front of them, and they just performed it with minimal action, and a narrator sort of read the important stage directions. It was a very powerful experience. They spent a moment locating us in the traditional territories of the Newchalneth peoples before we began, which I really appreciated, and just sort of gave us a couple of opening images that reflected elements of Nootka Sound, specifically the fog, and then they tied that into the beginning of the reading. I'm not sure if they've done that in the production. You'll have to go and check it out to see. But even without staging, it was very, very powerful, brought me to tears more than once. So it was a relief to be in a darkened room for that as I'm like blowing my nose into my program. No spoilers, but I will say that it contains one of the most staggering moments I've ever experienced in a theatrical production. And it used silence to achieve that.
Yes, you told me about this moment.
Yeah.
And It fired me up. I'll actually have to probably, I'm not a theater guy, really, but I'm going to have to go check it out.
Yeah, that's, I did my undergrad in theater, and but I still find now doing my master's in creative writing, I don't get out to a lot of shows myself. And I had the opportunity to do this because of an FNIS class that I'm taking with Dr. David Gertner, who had us all go out and write a review on a play. So great to see that. Very thankful to the Talking Stick Festival for bringing that to us. So if this sounds interesting to you out there, you may want to check out Red Patch at the Studio 16 Theatre in Vancouver, April 12th to 16th, or check them out online at redpatch.ca. They've got this cool interactive website. It's got info on Vimy Ridge and World War One, and also the development of the production itself.
Yeah. So, I don't know. With like, Canada is very, very pro, like, I don't want to just reiterate what I said earlier at the top there, but, like, you know, very, Canada sees itself as, like, forming in the First World War, and, like, particularly Vimy Ridge. And often, I think, like, the recent, I guess, like, bringing in, like, the Indigenous history that was always there into, like, the mainstream, like, oh, actually, like there were Indigenous snipers and all that. But, like, a lot of the contributions seem to fall into, like, a sort of, definitely a narrative of it, like a familiar one, like the description of Henry Norwest as being like a stealthy guy who used his camouflage and all that. Maybe that does come from, like, he just knew how to hunt because he grew up hunting, but maybe, like, the people who were giving those accounts had, you know, they were like coming from a very specific place. Like, I know, like, I read a memoir by Ernst Jünger, who was on the German side, Storm of Steel. It's, like, pretty well-known memoir of First World War combat. And he tells, like, this very ghastly account of going up against British colonial troops from India. That's, like, filled with all sorts of stereotypes, but, you know, it's, like, his eyewitness account, the things that are exaggerated, you know, they're just there. They're in the record, so it gets strange, I guess.
Yeah, I like what you're saying here, and I think the elements of stereotyping, that gets addressed quite directly in the production of Red Patch. I thought about that too, as this character is praised for, I mean, basically what we consider sort of elements of Indianness. Of First Nations-ness, his stealth and his ability to use camouflage, which I think, yeah, as you're saying, could result from practical reasons. But the character Half-Blood, that's what he goes by in the right. In the production, is he faces a lot of racist treatment from the soldiers in his. What's even the word? I'm not much of a war buff myself. Platoon. I'm going to go ahead and say platoon. They do gradually sort of develop a respect for the work that he does. But, you know, he's sneaking off at night and basically killing German soldiers and using these practical skills that he has as growing up in as a member of the Nechelnut Nation. But there's just something about that that's always a little...
I know, like, I've tried to investigate my own family history because, like, if I were going to be a war buff, First World War, that'd be my thing. It's got, like, all the whole things of modernity crashing into itself, kind of, and just bursting onto the scene, and, like, in a very awful, violent way. So it's got all these elements to it that I find very interesting. So and I wanted to know, like, well, has my family been involved in the First World War? So I've done some research, and, like, a lot of people from my community and the communities around the James Bay Coast actually, like, weren't typically assigned to, like, a combat unit. It was, like, forestry or engineering corps, so they were, like, building things over there, or, like, doing more what you'd consider non-war labor, but, like, all towards the war effort. But you don't really hear about that as much, so much as, like, you know, the native hunter out in, like, the battlefields of France,
yeah.
Which is a very exotic look,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. My Métis grandmother, Marjorie Carrière, actually sang for troops in World War II.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And she was a veteran.
Jeez.
Yeah. At the Sirocco Club, I think, in Victoria. These are the things you pick up. These are the things you learn about your family. Who knew?
I did not.
Yeah. Well, you didn't. Yeah.
Well, either way.
Now you do. Yeah. You told me a story before the show began about, just a little vignette.
I don't know if this is true or not, but in Cree, like James Bay in Northern Ontario, you would refer to the James Bay as Winnipeco, which just means muddy water. It's where the like, same, they also speak Cree near Winnipeg. Winnipeg got the same name, Winnipeg, because speaking the same language. But this guy coming from, it was either the First World War or the Second World War, I don't know. But he was asked, well, where are you going home to? And he said, oh, Winnipeg. And then he got a ticket to Winnipeg and had to figure out things from there. because he was in the middle of a place he had no idea. So I don't know. Like, I don't know, the treatment of Indigenous veterans has been a cause for concern,
yeah.
I think, for a long time in Canada.
No, that was, that definitely is the lighter side of things, but we were also talking about Indigenous peoples returning from combat to find that they had their status had been revoked and they weren't able to go back and live on reserves.
Yeah, and like enfranchisement. Real rough stuff. Like when, especially compared to like a lot of times, like veterans would come home and they could apply for through a veterans board of some kind. Like they could apply to get farmland somewhere, typically native farmland, typically appropriated Indigenous land that was then would be given to veterans. And like granted, that's not across the board. Like a lot of veterans had a hard time coming back, whether or not they were Indigenous. But at least they were legally allowed to go live in their own communities. As far as I know. So, yeah. Do you know if Red Patch gets into the coming home bit at all?
From a community perspective, okay. It doesn't go into the politics beyond that.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll hear a little song from Willie Dunn here, and then after that we'll come back and we'll give the Nathan E. Stewart investigation some discussion. Clara was on the scene for that, we're going to hear from her. But first, we'll hear from Willie Dunn, Son of the Sun.
Now repeat after me.
Or not.
Bugger off. Bugger off. Sod. Sod. Bloody. Bloody. Now put them all together. Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Okay, you're in.
Let's smash things up.
Every Saturday, from noon to 1 p.m., listen to Generation Annihilation on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC Radio in Vancouver.
Son of the sun, son of the earth, the soul of life, children of the world, daughters of starlight, and daughters of mirth, sisters of sunlight, sisters of earth, brothers of nature, brothers of old, brothers of legend. And the story untold. I had a dream a mile of coal. It laid to rest with a gun and a sword. Buried the hatchet, buried the snake, bowed to each other. The earth supplies and nature feeds, but we turn and quake for artificial needs. Come down to earth and stay a while. The sun is shining, just sit there and smile. Thank you. a brown skinned man. That's what I am. Got a guitar and a drum. That's where I come from. Spirit of the sun, spirit of the sea, worthy of the shadow I'm shining down on. Son of the sun, son of the earth, soul of life, children of the world, brothers of nature, brothers of old, brothers of legend and story untold, daughters of starlight, daughters of earth, sisters of sunlight, sisters of birth. A mile ago, if they drew rest, the gun and the sword, they buried the hatchet, they buried the snake, bowed to each other, peace to make. Oh, son of the sun.
Spring coming right along. Ooh, about a nice way to ask her for a song. So I asked the mountain if she might want to move me. She said tell the rivers to wake up the lake. See, rivers take it from sky into home base. And yellow belly hawks know how to kill taste. Singing for the spring is like kissing pretty things. And changes like fire, changes like rain. Birch bark and maple and seas of black hair. Raven sing, show, show, now feel the hair.
Oh,
Do you love the idea of empowering female youth through music creation and performance? Girls Rock Camp Vancouver is a 100% volunteer-driven nonprofit that promotes self-esteem and builds technical skills in female and non-binary youth ages 8 to 18. Help support this initiative by donating, volunteering, or attending their end-of-camp performance July 15th at the Rio Theater. If you're interested in being a camper or volunteering with Girls Rock Camp, visit girlsrockcampvancouver.ca.
You heard from Willie Dunn, you heard Son of the Sun from his album The Vanity of Human Wishes, which is a great title, which he released in 1984. Willie Dunn was of mixed Mi'kmaq and Scottish-Irish background. After that, you heard Digging Roots, the song Spring to Come from their album We Are, which they released in 2009. So Digging Roots is a duo, husband and wife team of Raven Kanetakta, who's from the Winneway community in Quebec, and Shoshona Kish from the Batchewana First Nation. And up next, we're going to have a segment from Clara, who was on the scene when the Heltsik First Nation, I guess, you were on assignment, I guess we could say.
Yes, I was covering the story of their releasing their investigation report on the 48 hours after the grounding of the Nathan E. Stewart. So they put together this very comprehensive report and had a news conference and some ceremonial protocol, and I was there covering that story.
Well, let's hear from that.
Particular area is so important to your people.
On October 13, 2016, Heltsik Nation suffered an unparalleled tragedy when the tugboat, the Nathan E. Stewart, ran aground, sank, and spilled over 110,000 liters of oil into one of our main food harvesting areas. The disaster triggered a memory of my late uncle. When the tide goes out, the table is set. These words have been a reoccurring thought since the Nathan E. Stewart tragedy. That day forever changed our lives as a community. We are still grieving.
You're listening to the voice of Chief Marilyn Slett as she describes the impact of the Nathan E. Stewart spill on the Heltsik Nation. On April 6th, the Heltsik Tribal Council released their investigation report on the 48 hours after the grounding of the Nathan E. Stewart and the resulting oil spill. It's a 75-page document that details the failures of the Government of Canada and Kirby Corporation's response to the incident and the profound impact that this has had and will continue to have on the Heltsik people. The song you heard in the intro was a Heltsik canoe song. Travis Hall, a Heltsik counselor and one of the drummers and singers, told me that he used this canoe song because, in his words, in a situation like this, we all need to be together and have the same ideas and move towards the same direction as one. A strong expression of solidarity was shown by Jim Q and Carlene Thomas on behalf of the Musqueam and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
Musqueam Nation welcomes the Heltsik Nation and the Heltsik leadership to our sacred unsurrendered land. We are honored that Chief Slett has asked to speak from within the heart of our nation. Her voice is strong, her cause is just, her people are an ancient nation renowned for their integrity. For these reasons, we are proud to welcome Heltsik.
Osiem Nitsiaya, I Tenishqualawin, Kwatsi Kwatsnala Ihui, and the Ansachalot, and the Manasanthaya Itsiat Makslaho Siem. And the imith queth on sachalot queth slahot sayem. Hait sepka, meet sep quit wheelum, eat swahotmish, eat homusquium, eat slawatothomas. We welcome you here to our homelands and waters, And I too would like to give thanks to the Heltsuk for honoring us to and asking us to come and provide this protocol. And Tsleil-Waututh too does stand shoulder to shoulder with the Heltsuk in our never-ending fight to protect our homelands and waters.
For someone who doesn't rely on a traditional food source for sustenance, it's difficult to grasp the magnitude of this event for the Heltsuk people. Harvey Humchit is a hereditary chief, as well as the research coordinator for the Heltsuk Integrated Resource Management Department. I asked him to tell me why this particular area where the spill occurred is so important to his people.
My name is Harvey Humchit, Chief Uyghur Palakis. I'm one of the hereditary chiefs of the Heltsuk Nation.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about food security and why ecologically and culturally, why this particular area is so important to your people?
My people, they harvest their clams from that area, from Gale Pass and Seaforth Channel, and the herring gather around that area to spawn, and it's important for people. This year we didn't have any people clam digging in the area because of the fuel contamination. In the future, I don't know how long that spill is going to affect a closure for the clam fishery.
Food security is central to this story, but it isn't just the food source that was threatened by the Nathan E. Stewart incident. It's also the long-standing cultural traditions closely tied to these resources. Travis Hall explains more.
The ocean has been the main source of our sustenance, of our livelihood, of everything that we've become. So to have something like this come in and destroy part of our ocean, part of our land, it's so devastating that we need to continually show people how connected we are to the water. It's not about just the economy. It's not about anything like creating jobs. It's about also harvesting food, you know, making sure our kids know how to do that in the future.
Learning about the importance of these cultural resources helps put into perspective why this incident affects the Heltsuk Nation so profoundly. The Heltsuk Investigation Report is a very thorough document that explains the multitude of ways in which the federal government and Kirby Corporation failed in their response. It calls into question our so-called world-class oil response regime.
When I got up on the scene, we realized that there was no one in command. We recognized that there was no booms. Going back on October 13th, the call went out and we were given wrong information. We were told that the Nathan E. Stewart ran aground at Dearth Island, where in fact it had run aground about 3 or 4 miles north of Dearth Island at Gale Passage. The Nathan E. Stewart, in my view, didn't need to sink. It didn't have to sink the way that it did. This is a wake-up call for us. We really need to be part of any process that the governments are putting together. We want to be consulted, and we're looking for setting up marine centers to respond to incidents like this. 48 hours, no one showed up. The damage was already done. 48 hours, the first booms went out. And they were ineffective. The tides and the winds in Gale Passage is strong. Even up to the very last day when they pulled Nathan E. Stewart out of the water, he could still smell the strong stench of diesel.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. You've been listening to Clara's coverage of the Halcyuk Nation's findings on the grounding of the Nathan E. Stewart and the oil spill. Clara, can you tell us a little bit about the Halcyuk's findings? There's a big document that accompanies this report. Can you tell us about the Halcyuk's findings of the response to the government after the grounding and the spill?
Sure. So the Halcyuk released their investigation report, which was an effort to determine if the response that day on October 13 violated their traditional laws, their Gwelas. And I was actually quite shocked to hear about the incompetence and the disregard for Halcyuk sovereignty in the response on that day. There were a multitude of things that went wrong. It took an entire 48 hours, as you just heard, for any booms to be set up to contain the diesel. And I think what also struck me was that there was so little communication between the federal government and Kirby Corporation and the Halcyuk Nation. And this is really troubling because the Halcyuk obviously are the first people there. They have the most at stake, but they also know the area better than anyone else and are best positioned to respond to an incident such as this. And they were there, but weren't given any information about what was going on. So I think that's the main failure, is that there was no communication and it was chaotic and disoriented.
It has seemed to me, an outsider to all this, that it's like maybe the response is one thing, but the preparation for something like this to happen also really didn't seem to how much consultation that Kirby Corporation had to do to take this route, or that the federal government had to give to sign off on this tug being on this route. So it sounds like the mistakes were made before this ever happened.
Absolutely, yeah. That's the other thing, is that they were not aware of this tugboat being there and had other issues in the past with this corporation. And if they had been involved previously with those types of processes, maybe there would have been an alternative route that wasn't going to directly compromise their food source and their cultural resources in such a terrible way. And the other thing that I was shocked by was that there was the corporation received an exemption to have a local pilot aboard, so it was not a Canadian pilot as the shipping regulations normally allow, but they, to save some money, I guess, they had a foreign pilot, and that was shocking and infuriating to the nation. I heard from elected Chief Marilyn Slett that this was very frustrating to see that they didn't have someone who knew the waters and who was basically they didn't have a qualified pilot aboard.
Well, so there's a bit more to hear from the press conference. Do you want to share that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the things that I was most impressed by, or what struck me the most, was the Halcyuk response. So I asked Chief Harvey Humchit a little bit about that.
It seems like there was an overwhelming response from the Halcyuk First Nation to protect their territory. What do you think you observed about the character of the Halcyuk people throughout this incident?
I would say world class. world class, the coastal communities, the way that they respond to assist others in trouble on their water, the way that they come to aid people when there's a need to be there. I worked with the Coast Guard Auxiliary for about 17 years, and we've always been volunteers. So I would say that coastal communities are the world-class responders, more so than what we've seen industry or the governments perform.
So the government and industry call it world-class, but you guys actually are the world-class response system.
I would suggest that.
Powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. You can catch All Access Pass every Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
That was Chris Dirksen with Smile at Me from The Cusp, his 2010 album. Chris Dirksen is Cree from the North Tall Cree First Nation in northern Alberta. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Yeah, we're moving into our unceded events listing here. I don't know. We've been unable to find a whole heck of a lot that we are aware is going on. So, you know, if you know of things, post it to hashtag Unceded Events on Twitter. But we know for sure that Hardline Productions' new play, Red Patch, all about First World War, will be running from April 12th to the 16th at Studio 16 in Vancouver. Tickets are available at hardlineproductions.ca. And also, we got a pretty special unceded event happening this Wednesday.
That's right. Our very own Carly Baker, Indigenous Collective member, who is in the studio with us today, is launching her new short story collection, Bad Endings, at the Book Warehouse Main Street on Wednesday. That's April 12th, and it's happening at 7 p.m. She'll be reading with a few friends, Patrick Sampler, whose new book, The Ocean Container, is coming out this spring with Nine Bark Press, as well as Cree Métis Icelandic poet and author Yonina Curtin. And her book, An Honest Woman, is also coming out this spring with Talon Books. And we're very much looking forward to that, Carly.
Thank you, Claire, for that completely unsolicited plug for my book. Unplanned. Spontaneous.
Of course.
A big thanks to Josh Kiyoki and Clara Salter for joining me today, and to everyone out there listening. Also, big thanks to our sponsors, NORAD Electric, supplying the finest in commercial, industrial, and residential electric work. Taltan owned and operated for over 30 years. Thanks also to Decolonizing Water, who aims to support water security for Indigenous communities. Decolonizing Water is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council, bringing together Indigenous thinkers, natural scientists, artists, lawyers, and community members. I'm Carly Baker, and you're listening to Unceded Airwaves, CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. And to finish off our show, we have Saltwater Hank with Skeena River Breakdown.
One, two, and one, two, three.